but I'd also had a bad experience that had soured me on marijuana. Once, when I was in college, I'd gone with Lena to a party hosted by some friends of hers, and they were all smoking a lot of dope. To be sociable, I did my part by taking a hit off whatever was passed my way. These friends of Lena's, Lenny and Cookie, lived a block away from a mile-deep stone quarry. I used to drive by it on the way to their house and slow down the car to marvel at its depth. But on this particular night, the higher I got, the more I became convinced that I would wander away from the party, stumble into the quarry, and plummet to my death. I would lie unnoticed for several days, get covered by gravel, and eventually become part of someone's new driveway. This scenario was unlikely, however. The quarry not only had a 10-foot high chain link fence around it, but it was also a block away from Lenny and Cookies, and I was having no trouble navigating myself across the living room in my altered mental state. My fear became so intense, however, that I barricaded myself inside the bathroom, putting the clothes hamper against the door. I lashed my wrist to the bathroom faucet with my necktie to prevent myself from coming to any harm. I recall the episode vividly as I rolled the fat joint I prepared for Darlene. I licked it closed, rolled it between my thumb and forefinger, and carefully laid it in the ashtray. Evil weed, stay away. Darlene came into the room wearing a burgundy dress with black lace trim. The plunging neckline seemed more revealing than her slip. She had on dark hose and black high heels. Her toes came to such a severe point that I couldn't imagine where one toe had nestled, let alone five. She looked as though she'd gained a little weight since the first time she'd worn the dress, but she looked good packed into it. I didn't mind an ample figure. It was probably all those European women I'd seen in films from the 40s and 50s. Virgin's women weren't fat, but they also didn't worry about having an extra helping of kippers at breakfast. I was, in fact, envious of the way the dress hugged her. It defined her shape with clarity, while I felt formless and lost in my big suit. "Does this look okay?" Darlene asked. I nodded. Darlene reached in front of me for the joint in the ashtray, and a head full of perfumed hair filled my nostrils. I didn't move away, drinking in as much as I could. I snatched up a book of matches and lit the joint for her. The smell of her perfume was soon replaced by the pungent odor of a very special kind of smoke. Darlene took a voracious suck and handed it to me. "Take a hit," she said, her offer spoken entirely as an inhale. "No, thanks," I said, as politely as if I'd been offered one of those little cocktail wieners wrapped in bacon. I handed it back to her and she took another substantial hit off it, turning a quarter inch of it into ash. "Kind of small," Darlene said, smiling and blinking. "I think it has something to do with my suit," I said. "It makes everything around me appear smaller." As Darlene took another enthusiastic pull on the joint, I was transfixed by the sight of her bright red lips around it, like a freshly painted hydrant gripping a gray fire hose. I imagined her lips on my lips, on my face, on my neck, on my chest. I suddenly thought I might want to experience one of her kisses again, but I kept thinking of the time. I didn't want to start something I couldn't finish. Maybe later, I thought. At the very least, however, I needed to feel something that those lips of hers had touched. If I'd been really enterprising, I suppose I could have excused myself, gone into her bathroom, and rubbed her toothbrush all over my body. But I stared at the joint glowing warmly in the ashtray with her red lipstick caked around the end of it. It was too tempting. I picked up the joint and held it near my mouth. The smell of the lipstick was intoxicating. "Don't inhale," I told myself. "Just touch it to your lips." I put the joint to my lips and inhaled deeply. "What did I just tell you?" I asked myself. But it didn't seem so bad, so I took a few more puffs on it. I ignored what I knew, that it never seems so bad until it's too late. A few minutes later, I started to feel buoyant, like a balloon that slips from the grasp of a small child and sails heavenward. Suddenly, it mattered very little to me whether or not it was getting late or whether or not there was a wedding at all. I didn't mind being right where I was. I did feel a little, however, like the room was getting smaller. I got up off the couch and marched around, making sure I could still walk 6 or 7 paces in whatever direction I chose. Then I became self-conscious about doing this. I stopped in front of a framed photograph of a skyscraper. I studied it intently, tall, shiny, hundreds of windows. I studied it so intently, in fact, that I suddenly felt my nose against the glass. I stepped back and rubbed away the smudge I'd made with my nose. "This is nice," I said. "How can you tell when you're on top of it?" Darlene asked. Sometimes you have to be on top of something before you can distance yourself from it, I said. I didn't know what I meant. But in my current mood, it sounded wonderfully deep and philosophical. Then I sighed deeply and choked back a cry. What's wrong? Darlene asked. Nothing, I said stoically. We'd better get going. What I couldn't tell her was that I'd been looking at all those windows on the skyscraper, wondering who was going to clean them. It seemed incredibly sad. Darlene drove. I was familiar with the church where Lena was getting married, but I didn't let on by offering directions. I sat silently in the passenger seat and didn't say anything. Darlene pushed a tape into her cassette, and a cacophony of loud funk metal tore up the interior of the Pacer. The windows were open, and my hair got tousled about. The rest of my body felt like it was underwater, the waves lapping gently at my ears. When the Pacer arrived in the parking lot, I announced, I am here! When I suddenly realized how loud I'd said it, I slumped back down in the seat momentarily. Then I swung open my door, jumped out of the car, and curled around to the driver's side to open Darlene's door for her. I was messed up, but I was a messed up gentleman. I opened her door and a pair of legs slid out. Her black leather pumps shimmered in the late afternoon sun, and her legs grew out of them, majestic and perfect. For a moment, the rest of her ceased to exist. I thought of 1,001 things to do with her leg. I would caress them and kiss them and bathe them and wax them and write poems to them and then hump them. But later, I told myself, not now, not in the parking lot of Our Lady of the Immaculate Conception. As Darlene walked up the steps of the church, I felt myself gliding behind her, effortlessly and rapidly, like a grocery store conveyor belt for 10 items or less. As I entered the church, I looked furtively to my right and left, but didn't see Lena or anyone else I knew. The few who had already gathered must be Andrew's family and friends, I thought, the Buntrock side. I shadowed Darlene closely as she moved up the aisle, crouching low behind her like Groucho Marx. As Darlene and I neared the front of the church, I thought I recognized the person sitting behind the piano. He had blonde hair tied back in a ponytail. I thought it might have been one of Lena's old high school friends, someone I'd met briefly at a party and forgotten, perhaps. I stayed close behind Darlene, prepared to pass myself off as her train, if necessary. But before I knew it, Darlene was introducing me to this person. Malcolm, you remember Kevin, the drummer? I told you he plays classical piano. Yes, I said, greatly relieved. I pumped his outstretched hand. You're the drummer with the circadian rhythm section. I've got all your albums. But we don't have a label yet, he said. So what are labels anyway, I said. It's all very arbitrary. Kevin frowned at me, then turned to Darlene. Who the fuck did you say this guy was? It's Malcolm, she said, the one in the men's room at the club. His expression changed. He grinned and shook my hand more enthusiastically. The one who whimpers in his sleep. Too much, man, too much. Warming to his sudden acceptance of me, I sidled up next to him at the piano. Outrageous threads, Kevin said. Way big. Thanks, I said, suddenly confident in my big suit. I spaced out my fingers on my left hand and played a C chord. It was all I could remember from a year of childhood lessons. In my current condition, I thought it might come back to me in a sudden rush. I cracked my knuckles, placed my fingers over the piano again, and waited for inspiration. What should we start off with, I said. Something in a popular vein, I should think. Something up-tempo to put the crowd in a good mood. Girl from Ipanema, Ventura Highway, perhaps. Keep in mind, I can only play the one chord. I spaced my fingers and played the C chord again. This guy's too much, Kevin said, slapping his knee and grinning from ear to ear. He's high, Darlene said. Keep his hands off the piano. Kevin gently lifted my hands off the keyboard and put them in my lap. There's a guy who's been looking for you, he said. Dope paranoia kicked in full gear. Looking for me? Who? Who would be looking for me? Ricardo Pisces. Ricardo Pisces is somebody that worked at this club that Darlene was at and saw him whimpering and sleeping in the bathroom and thought it was performance art. Oh, I said, feeling the blood flow back into all the regular areas of my body. He says you're unsigned, Kevin said, that you don't have a label yet. It's true, I said solemnly. I'm unsigned. I have no label. This is how I'll be remembered, I thought, the man with no label. He rode into town, played one chord on the piano, whimpered in his sleep, and moved on.